Hello, and welcome to our podcast. I'm Jessica Brown, linguistic editor at Culturico, and today we are talking with a poet from Ireland, Kieran O'Rourke.
The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic, yet realistic, mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Kieran O'Rourke is an Irish poet now based in Galway. His first collection, The Buried Breath, was issued by Irish Pages Press in 2018 and highly commended by the Forward Foundation. His pamphlet, Glass Life, are pandemic poems and was published as a ragpicker edition in 2021. He runs the online archive of poetry-themed interviews at Island's Edge Poetry, and a new poetry collection, Phantom Gang, is due out later this year. I'm so looking forward to our conversation together, and I hope you listeners get to enjoy it too. Kieran, welcome to the Culturico podcast.
Thank you so much, Jessica. I'm very happy to be here.
To set the scene for our listeners, where are you right now?
So I'm talking to you from Galway on the west coast of Ireland. I'm from Dublin originally, which is on the east coast.
Do you have any vistas outside your window, or where are you in Galway, in the city?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So it's a weathery day here in Galway. It's brighter than it was, thankfully, a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And I can almost smell the sea if I stick my head outside the window, the Atlantic Ocean.
That's lovely. And I'm calling just south from there. I'm in an attic room on the main street of a little town in East Clare, Killaloe, where Lough Derg and River Shannon meet. I have to walk and look out a very specific way, but I can see the mountain town Tinna across Lough Derg, and it's a cold, bright, resplendent day. And as Kieran was saying, it's brighter than it's been a couple weeks ago, which is wonderful. Kieran, I thought we could start this conversation about poetry and about your poetry writing practice and the insights poetry can give us by having you read one of your poems, and then we could talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So this poem is called Sea Point. And just to say at the beginning that Sea Point is the name of a place in Dublin where I like to go sea swimming along with many others. I'm not sure what your attitude to sea swimming was before you arrived in Ireland, Jessica, but you probably know that lots of people do it all the time and all year round. So this is a kind of observational poem about that strange community of people that I'm happy to be a part of. Sea Point. Once the curlew slinks away, the swimmers come back daily, like the lady who folds a skull cap brightly round her face, treading the bone grey water in delicate beret, or this other swaying into it, all talk, who holds two fingers pinched and raised until her head quicks under cold. And here's a man who lifts each step with studious attention, one arm hovering above the rail, whose sea-bowed eyes reiterate the light my late grandfather's seemed to keep as he slows his body into place to stand waist deep in the gathering tide.
Thank you so much, Kieran. Oh, my first response is that this is an incredibly beautiful poem. And those who are listening in, you know, I was able to follow along as Kieran was reading, and I'm just really moved by the way the lines work with the white space on the page and the way each word is important. Each word matters. That's kind of, I suppose that's one of poetry's great gifts, is that each word matters. And each word does a lot of work. I think there's an investment here in the word choices. Like I said, they're quite precise and each word is doing a lot. One of my favorite things about it is that with each word, I'm drawn more and more into this C point location, but not just the location. I'm actually drawn more and more into the faces and the people who are entering the water.
Well, thank you so much. Those are really very thoughtful and generous observations. So I appreciate the close reading, Jessica. I spent quite a few years in college studying the work of the American poet William Carlos Williams. I actually did a PhD on him in the end. But I think he tends to be associated with that kind of poetry that you've just described, where, you know, it's kind of a colloquial and seemingly simple language, kind of very concise and clear images, almost a kind of minimalist poetry, which has its own complexity as it unfolds. And I'm not sure that I've necessarily managed to kind of to achieve everything that I might have with that poem, but I think I was maybe borrowing from Williams in his general approach to the poem. And as you say, the people, I think the various figures who appear in the poem are the main characters. And I think he had a kind of democratic instinct in his own life and in his own work. So maybe there's an inflection from Williams there as well. I'm not sure.
Oh, I could see that. I could really see that because I tell me now if I'm wrong, but I think he was a doctor as well, kind of his day job. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for four decades.
So there's a kind of tenderness, an observational tenderness to the bodies in this poem. And I think that that could very well be something that makes me think of Williams. He wasn't just like site specific or word specific, but he's kind of body specific. I think that might have, I don't know, you're the one who did the dissertation on him, but it seems like, I wonder if his years of being a doctor would have lent him that. And it certainly makes its way into this poem, this kind of being incredibly present to the bodies that are nearby.
Thank you. Yeah, I part of what I love about Williams's work is his human warmth, because it would be very easy for that kind of imagistic, pared back style of poetry to become kind of chilly, you know, or inhuman. Whereas I think his work is anything but. You know, it's the opposite. And again, I'm not sure that I've necessarily, achieved that kind of fully rounded pared back style of observation that he was such a master of. But he was definitely an influence. And I think, you know, it's coming from my own life as well. That's another thing. It wasn't just an exercise, but this particular older swimmer in Sea Point reminded me of my granddad, who had recently enough passed away. So I think there was that identification. There was also a kind of, a deeper recognition that I was trying to get at in the poem, which is that this strange ritual of sea swimming, which if you describe objectively sounds totally bonkers, but it's a way of giving yourself back to the world. And it's a way of being lonely, but with other people, because we're all coming back to this same ritual, this same place. So I think all of that is maybe knocking around in the, whatever the dominant emotion in the poem is. I think it's some combination of those aspects I just mentioned.
Oh, I think so too. I think one thing you definitely achieved here, which is one thing I really love about it, is the tenderness. There's a, you know, kind of like in some films when the director lets the lens rest on people, it's almost like we allow ourselves to be transfixed by another human being. And to me, there's, I don't know, that's quite humane. It's watchful, it's humble, and it's ultimately very connected, because we kind of get out of the way a little bit and we allow this kind of watching to take in all the details of another human being. And then to add what you said, this watching is happening at this scene of people kind of entering into this luminous water place, you know, it's not earth, and kind of letting go, you know, when you enter into the ocean, you got to let go a little bit. So I think you're right. All that would be working here without it being said in an overt way, but in a quite precise, detailed way. I wonder, so as a listener or a reader, it kind of does what I think poetry also does as its core. You know, every word matters, but kind of leaving just the craft space, but kind of the vision, like how does poetry teach us to see? I mean, I think that's exactly what it's doing. It's as a reader and a listener, as I hear and read the poem, it actually gives me an example of what it's like to see, or in what it's like to watch, and what it's like to be in the world, what it's like to go to Sea Point and have a kind of poetic resonance, which doesn't just mean kind of like you said, it's not just kind of a cold intellectual exercise. It's actually being in the world that's maybe a groundedness or a connecting way.
Thank you. Yeah, I love the analogy that you suggested of the camera lens, the poem being somewhat like a camera lens, kind of slowly focusing in on the lives of other people. And I think the question of voyeurism is probably an interesting one for any poet to ask of themselves, honestly. But I think, you know, voyeurism is one thing, but there's also, I think, certainly in the kind of poetry that I love to read, there's, you know, the craft becomes a craft founded on the discipline of compassion. And that probably sounds too regimented, but the idea is that there's some kind of human identification at work, you know, within the poem or kind of just beyond the sense of the poem. And again, I'm not sure whether that necessarily worked out completely in this particular piece, but I think in general, that's the kind of poetry that I'm interested in, that sort of reaches beyond the author's own solipsism or kind of self-absorption, or indeed the poem's self-containment that tries to reach into life or into the world in some way. Yeah, I'm speaking as much as a reader, as a writer, when I say that.
Yeah, I love what you said. At some point, I think it's a literary critic I really like, Alan Jacobs, talks about a hermeneutics of love. And it kind of has to do with where attention becomes kind of a compassion or a taking in of the other or of something beyond us. And that's kind of when the magic happens. It's like, it's not just our own mind thinking things out. It's us being attentive and seeing what can come in and letting the text find its way that way.
Oh, I completely agree with that. Yeah. I think in some ways, poetry might be synonymous with a kind of heightened attention or a kind of general attentiveness. Yeah. Whether, you know, you can define that in different ways, but I completely agree. Yeah.
I'm a poet myself, and I find the process of making a poem kind of infinitely interesting. And I like talking to other poets and hearing what they do and how they do it. Kieran, how do you process a poem? And I know in some ways it's totally arbitrary, but I'd like to hear how you consider your process, and I kind of mean from its beginning, like when the idea maybe first lands or is just a glimmer of an idea, to when you would understand it or call it finished.
Sure. Well, that's a great question, firstly, and I hope I'm not being too evasive in my answer when I say that. I in some ways, I think poetry writes itself. And I don't mean that in a glib kind of way or kind of self-important way. I struggle and I kind of agonize over the poems. You know, I'm no different from anyone else in that regard. But I suppose I feel in general that there's a risk that in editorializing in retrospect, you can actually kill the poetry of this finely wrought thing that you're trying to produce. And so I try to remember, which isn't always easy, but that again, part of the craft of poetry is learning how and when to surrender it. Because I think past a certain point, your work will always belong to other people, which I think can be quite difficult to get your head around in some ways. But if you think about it, then even the most technically flawless poem that you've created, I think it's best thought of as a kind of blueprint, as a rough guide for whatever other people want to use it for, if indeed they do, and they may not. I suppose that's the kind of general emotional approach to poetry. I suppose on a technical level, I'm not really sure. I think most of my poems are nursery rhymes in the sense that they have a simple and reasonably consistent rhythm, but they're kind of running through them, but they don't necessarily, they're not laid out that way necessarily on the page. But I think the rhythm is what I hold to when I'm writing in the moment of writing. I'm not sure if that's your experience as well.
Yes, I think I love this idea of the rhythm kind of helping inform how you're following the lines of the poem and seeing what kind of, if there does need to be an editing move or crafting or sculpting, letting the rhythm inform that. I like, for myself, I often have come to think of what Denise Levertov talks about, a pelican flying over the shore. And it's the shoreline, that the lines on the page, how do they look to the pelican in kind of aerial view? And I think there's something there as well.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Isn't that good? Yeah, there's something quite, you're intuiting the shorelines and where, and I think there's something that's a rhythm too. You're it's the shape, I suppose, of a poem. What is your poetry practice like? How is it integrated into your life? Do you work on it every day or is it sporadic?
Oh, very much sporadic. So weeks and months will go by when I write nothing whatsoever. And then miraculously, the poetic fever comes back and takes me over somehow. I'm not entirely sure how that happens.
Yes.
But for me, the state of writing, which tends to kind of only occur in very brief intervals, but it's... I associate it with a feeling of undistraction, so of total focus and absorption in not just the words on the page, but as you said, this, this kind of the shape of the page and as it's kind of giving up its gift, which is the poem. And again, this interval never lasts particularly long, but that's how it happens for me. And then the rest of the time, I just try to live my life, I suppose. Maybe going back to what I said earlier about poems writing themselves, I suppose what I may have meant there was that I think the human animal, we accumulate a certain amount of experience. We gather up life inside us, and then after a certain point, we leave a residue. And I think poetry is one of the residues. So that's how I tend to think of it. Just as a way of kind of not worrying too much if I'm unproductive for weeks at a time. But,
that's beautiful. I love that. And I would really resonate with that answer. So much of poetry, of my own poetry writing practice, is exactly as you say. It's the residue of being present. And I think... and that also includes kind of an acceptance for when it's not happening, but you can kind of trust that you're just being in the world and, I don't know, things are building up somewhere.
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, actually. Yeah.
As I've read through your poems, one of the things that I probably most liked, most admired and enjoyed is that I found your poetry to be infused and resonating with the natural world. Do you think so? And why do you, and if so, why do you think, how did this happen? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think even on the most elemental, or I meant to say elementary, but elemental and elementary level, the poems do tend to register even the changing seasons or the shifting weathers day to day. And maybe all poems written in Ireland are a bit like that. As we said earlier, it's a very weathery kind of place. But I don't know, it is a very interesting question, though, because I'm conscious of the fact that people like Walt Whitman or Carl Sandburg or the painter Diego Rivera, at different points in their in their lives and in their careers, they created magnificent and rapturous art devoted to what you could call kind of industrial civilization or industrial modernity. And nobody's going to write that kind of poem today, I think. And yet, I think if we're fully honest with ourselves, we have to admit that the poetry scene and the general society that we're still living in are both still dependent on that same industrial civilization. It could be driven by fossil fuels, putting it bluntly. And so when I think about nature poetry, or when I think about the nature of poetry, maybe I'm probably more interested at this point in my life in the kind of poem that tries to shine a light on that particular contradiction or tension in our culture than I am necessarily in interested in a poem that might just express a kind of disapproval, a generalized disapproval of pollution or whatever it may be. And I don't mean to be too harsh when I say that. Of course, I read and write, or try to write, poems of every variety. But I think for me, poetry is at its most engaging and challenging and interesting when it is recognized as a way of exploring certain complexities. And insofar as that task or that process is compatible with nature poetry, for example, or with a poetry of nature, then I'm a nature poet, or I'd be glad to be a nature considered a nature poet. Yeah. But otherwise, I'm not so sure. But as I say, I think it's a brilliant question, and it really kind of goes to the heart of what we're about as readers and writers.
Oh, I agree. And I liked how you said it there. A lot of my poetry, I can't get away from the natural world. It makes its way into every poem. And then I am kind of bumping up against the fact of do I see the natural world, seeing it as a poet, does that kind of let me off the hook of caring for it or to being attentive in other forms of what humans live on the planet, how humans live on the planet?
I think that's that, I suppose, ambivalence or sense of tension is something that I also experience. And as even at the start of our conversation, I mentioned the brightness of the spring.
Yeah.
The truth is that not just as an aspiring poet, but as a person, I do draw a kind of solace and kind of comfort from the natural world, from natural seasons and rhythms and all of that. I'm not in any way discounting, the fact that we're creatures in the world, that maybe poetry reflects that condition in some way. I also think that poetry can be used as a kind of instrument of investigation and as a way of challenging ourselves to kind of outgrow our own complacencies. And, it can be used in all kinds of ways. So I'm just conscious of that.
I love that. Thank you. And I'm thinking of those words you said, comfort and solace. I use that as the kind of transition springboard into a poem of yours that I wanted to read for the listeners. This poem, Keepsake, was published in Poetry Ireland Review, issue 118. And I think it's like Sea Point, it sees with eyes that are hungry to see and eager to recognize, watch, care. And I think it also speaks very tenderly to how we try to navigate our tenuous time on this earth. Keepsake. The stone I cannot part with. I anchor it daily on the steep seabed of pages by my desk, a weight for paper and for poems, heartbeat heavy, but light enough to let the summer whisper in the sheaf when windows open or when I leave, thereby keeping in its skull dull, colorless, life perfecting way the rhythm of this room adrift. And your image too, pocketing sea stones years ago, your white dress bright on the eye gray shore, and you smiling there as if our waves on lovely sunder would not come, or as though the ocean might remember touch, the particles being hurled again as longing from your fists. Like here, where words must delve until the element resists and the vivid breath rebuild itself from the little that persists. That was Keepsake by Kieran O'Rourke. Kieran, we have a few minutes left, and I didn't want to leave without hearing two recommendations from you. One is a poem or a poet that our listeners can look up.
Sure. So the poet that I had in mind, well, actually, I'm not sure if I'm cheating a little bit with this answer, but I'd like to recommend a book-length poem by the Irish poet Dermot Healy. And the book or the poem is called A Fool's Errand. And it centers on the migration of a flock of barnacle geese between North America and Ireland. And it was written over years, if not decades. And the book was published in 2010. So that would be my poem.
That sounds beautiful. Okay, and that is, say again, the author in?
A Fool's Errand by Dermot Healy.
A Fool's Errand by Dermot Healy. That sounds amazing. I'm going to go. I know what I'm doing right after this podcast is over. And then I wanted to hear an idea for a poetry writing practice that anyone could try, whether they're into poetry as a reader, as a writer, or not at all. There is something about poetry that brings us into the world. Is there a poetry writing practice that you would recommend?
Well, this is a wonderful question. So I sometimes think that we presume that poets should only think about poetry. And in a way, I think that's a mistake. So, for example, I know nothing about football, but there was undeniable poetry in the exuberance and virtuosity with which Maradona played soccer. You know, there's poetry in the way that Martin Scorsese talks about movies and in the way that the late film critic Pauline Kael wrote about movies. And so my general advice, and maybe this is too abstract, but my advice would be just to try to stay open to the world, you know, to other people, to their passions and perspectives. And it's not that, you know, if you then try to write poetry that, you know, it will be amazing and wonderful and fully formed. You know, it's that I think as a person, you have a better chance of becoming a bit richer, I suppose, you know, or deeper, or kind of having a fuller awareness of your place in the world if you try to stay open in that way. And I think poetry can only benefit from that task or that process.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Kieran. Cultura Irico is so lucky to have you as a guest. I think this has been a blessed and invigorating and kindly talk. It's really important stuff as well. And I can't thank you enough for being here and for bringing such beautiful ideas and for sharing your poetry with us.
Thank you, Jessica. It really was a privilege to talk to you. And thanks for such generous and thoughtful questions and exchanges throughout.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay. See you, Jessica.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This episode of Cultura Irico was produced by Jessica Brown. If you want to read our latest articles on science and culture, you can find them at culturaico.com. To get our latest episodes, subscribe to Cultura Irico on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what we do, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. Thank you, and until next time.